All right, Zig coming in on the top. Today on the show, we have Stephen Blum, a singer-songwriter based out of New York, and he has a new album coming out called Out of the Nowhere, Into the Here. And what's cool about this record is Stephen's first record, which was self-titled, was mostly electronic instruments, and in this record, it's traditional orchestra instruments. And it's a really interesting crossover from an electronic approach of songwriting to an orchestrated approach to songwriting. And what's also cool about this new release, Out of the Nowhere, Into the Here, is Stephen's doing basically a double release of it. One, where it's the full song with the vocals, and the second one being just the instrumentation. Because the instrumentation on all these songs are very, very lush and beautiful. And he does like a reharm and like adds more instruments and does a whole other version of it, of just an instrumental version. So this album's coming out in twofold. And it will be available on all streaming platforms on April 19th. We're going to listen to a tune. This is a song called There Was a Light.
When I sleepily asked where thoughts and ideas come from, waves electric danced up my tummy and gave me some. There was a light. There was a lovely light. But I'll never know if it was all in my mind, or was it a light? I get sad when I think of arrogant things I said. I get scared that I was awakened in my ward bed. There was a light. There was a lovely light. But I'll never know if it a light. Warm vibrations fell on my chest from the soft white light. I sensed someone was telling me I would be all right. There was a light. There was a lovely light. But I'll never know if it was all in my mind, or was it a light? I am fortunate for my friends and my family. They were there for me. They're still there for me faithfully. There was a light. There was a lovely light. But I'll never know if it was all it alive. I get scared when I think of what I am capable of. Is she cruelty or indifference, or is she love? Thank you, my God. Thank you, my holy God. But I'll never know if it was all in my mind, or was it a light?
There Was a Light. The album is Out of the Nowhere into the Here. The artist, Stephen Blum. And we dive deeper into the song in particular, and it's a really moving story, Stephen's journey with this song. And I think one that's not easy for people to talk about, and I think it was really cool that he shared his journey with that. And that will be in the conversation. Before we move on, Stephen is having an album release show April 25th. In Hudson Valley at the Avalon Lounge. So if you're anywhere near the Avalon Lounge on April 25th, make your way there. It's going to be a good one. Lastly, if you can like, rate, review, subscribe to the podcast and any of the podcast platforms, it helps me keep talking to cool guests like Stephen and sharing his insight with you. Now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Stephen. Oh, man, the album is excellent. It's a very, very well-done record. And the kind of to jump into it, my first question I have about it, your last record being electronic and kind of writing music in that sense for those instruments, did you see if the, or did you find there was a carryover from going from a writing for like an electronic record to orchestra kind of based instrumentation, and or was it completely different?
Yeah, great question. Thanks a lot. And thanks for the kind comment on the record. And, you know, I'm really glad to be on Zig of the Gig. Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. There's definitely a carryover. The way I arranged for the orchestral instruments was actually just on my synthesizer. And for your audience, I recorded into Ableton. I just played all the parts manually, but used MIDI and then assigned the MIDI file so I could hear the parts played back on the computer by any instrument. And then I had sheet music made from the MIDI and then given to these instruments. But it was really a lot like doing the synthesizers, and I'd been doing the synthesizers so long. It was kind of the same process. It's just instead of assigning a part to a bass synthesizer, I would give it to a double bass or a cello, and so on. There are a lot of other little things you have to watch out for, like I ran into things like the oboe part on the MIDI goes lower than an oboe can play, so I had to get an English horn, which just goes a little bit lower, which is kind of the same instrument, just a slightly bigger and lower. And then a cello part, the little instrumental bit in the middle of any little thing, that's really easy to play on the keyboard, but is not easy to play at all on the cello. And it was really, really interesting to watch the cellist Jordan Gunn figure it out on the spot. But I had a lot of really fantastic players come. Jordan was from the Orchestra Now, which is Bard College's in Hudson Valley. It's a great music school. They're a postgraduate orchestra. So she was really fantastic. And she just, oh, we do hard stuff all the time. You know, it's just difficult to sight read. But yeah, it was kind of the same, really. It's just, I just like wanted to play with these different timbres and actually work with real people and have the sound of air on the record.
Well, I definitely think you got that. And like, it's interesting too, the kind of like hear from like, I mean, what's your main? Is your main guitar or piano?
I'd say guitar. And I'm picking up more and more piano. I did play the piano on the album. I wrote almost all the songs on the guitar and then transfer them to the piano.
Okay. So when, like, so you started writing on guitar, and guitar, like, from my understanding with my journey with guitar, because guitar is also my main, is very the opposite of kind of classical music welcoming. You know what I mean? Like, when you read guitar music, it's kind of all over the place. It's not like when you read music for piano where it kind of just makes sense. Guitar, you're like, which E am I starting with here? Which one will best fit? You know what I mean? Like, which one's going to best fit the phrase, like, four bars down? And, like, so it's a different, like, at least for me, a different headspace to do those two types of that type of music on guitar. And, like, so to kind of come from that is a really interesting background to be composing like you are. So when you're working with, like, I mean, are you close with these musicians you brought in? Did you know them, or did you just kind of hire them for this record?
For the most part, just hired them for their record.
Okay, because it's really interesting when, like, you hear like a kind of a classical musician's journey and like how they kind of like are fighting these like sight reading battles. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, for someone who's composing like how you did on a keyboard, which is completely different than like how a cellist would play. And it's like, man, these guys are so good.
Like, yeah. Well, I was really blessed to, you know, I live in the Hudson Valley. I'm really blessed to have Bard College down the road for all the musicians that I couldn't find, you know, in the hills here. Not everybody plays the English horn, but there are a lot of players at Bard who play French horn and English horn, and, you know, everything.
Now, I guess opposed to, or before, like, writing for this, were you kind of aware of some of those, like, orchestra instrument limitations? Or was this a learning process when you'd bring in someone and they couldn't do it?
I'd say a mix. Fortunately, we caught a lot of that stuff in the sheet music. When I gave it to one of my collaborators, Andrew Stein's father, who professionally takes MIDI and puts them into sheet music. He's a orchestra high school teacher, so very well experienced. And he corrected me on a few things, like, "Oh, you don't want the E flat clarinet. That's like an oddball instrument, kind of a novelty. You want the B flat clarinet, dude." You know, things like that. I guess I had just assumed more often that the keyboard oboe sound would be what the oboe can play.
right. It's also fascinating too with like how when you score something out in Ableton, how it kind of writes it for you, like it writes the sheet music for you. Did he have any like feedback on like, "Oh, it's really written like this," you know?
I didn't really use like sheet music in Ableton specifically. It was just the MIDI files. I didn't look at the sheet music. But because I was playing the parts by hand, they weren't really ever quantized into a neat, you know, readable sheet music. That was kind of his job. So, yeah, it's a little different from like writing sheet music in Ableton, I think, because I wasn't even trying to do that. Because the hand is never going to, you know, the human hand is never going to play everything exactly in time. The sheet music timing comes out really awkwardly, not on the beat. And so his job was kind of cleaning all that up. But that was kind of understood from the beginning.
That's cool, though. It's still like one of those like processes where now it's like something that may have been completely done internally for you, coming from like the electronic kind of back, at least last record, in branching out to other people like this, because that's like a whole step before you even start making it, to have someone kind of like proofread your you know what I mean, your draft.
Yeah, sure.
Now, was that like kind of like, was this record in particular, I mean, aside from just instruments, like in reaching out to all these musicians, was that kind of a big part of it, was reaching out to more people? and working and collaborating with more people?
Yeah. I've worked by myself for so long. I've run up against a lot of limitations about just being by yourself. For one thing, it's harder to get music out there when you're just one person. Every time you bring somebody else into the team, it's a recipe for maybe more things to go wrong, scheduling conflicts, reliability issues. But also you bring in more people who care about what you're doing. And so you can spread that out a little bit more. So that's really nice. And just like exchanging ideas and feedback. And I for this project, it kind of kept blossoming. As I started connecting with the musicians, I thought, I don't have to stop here. I can start adding an oboe part or a French horn part. And then, geez, I should go back and add more bass clarinet. So I kept kind of editing it and evolving it as I realized what opportunities I had working with more of these musicians. And it became a little bit more elaborate and lush because of that.
That's awesome. That's definitely like, I agree with what you said. Once you like, even just have someone in a, like, you know, a band of two people, you know, it feels like someone else has got your back when you're going against the world, you know, and like, that's like an irreplaceable kind of support. So I can see why that kept growing.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it now because now that I'm done working with the musicians and back to getting the album out, it's mostly just me trying to get it out again. It is really a struggle.
Yeah, that's, someone's always going to take the lead. Someone's always going to drive the van. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I totally relate to that. Oh my God. But okay. So let's kind of like, I guess as far as your songwriting is really, really particular, and how you involve these classical flavors into songwriting, especially on this record. And I even noticed it a little bit on the last record. It's really particular and really cool. Now, your brother, or was it your brother or your sister, introduced you to Bowie and Lou Reed, right?
Yeah, actually both of them. Okay. It was my sister's David Bowie CD I borrowed when I was like 13 or 14, and my brother had given me Lou Reed's Transformer for my 13th birthday, which was quite a present. So it's nice to have older siblings sometimes.
Right. Starting from that, you're kind of diving into a very unique voice in each one of those musicians. I guess kind of tracing your songwriting history, when did you start like writing? Was it from Bowie and Lou Reed, and like, did you pick up the guitar from that? What's this kind of journey look like?
Well, honestly, I was kind of wired with something that made me want to create songs, even just on a toy drum I had when I was like three, and then later on drum sets. Like I stayed at my mom's friend's house once when my mom was away, and she had a drum set. And this was when I was in third grade, and I was writing songs on the drum set. And then I remember going to school all day, you know, excited to come back and play the songs I'd written on the drum set. Not really ever understanding a drum set isn't really used to write songs typically, you know, but I had the drums all planned out a specific way to play them in order. And then I remembered that and played it again for everybody, for my mom when she came. I remember writing songs for like my second grade class and singing them. Later on, I found out my siblings did that too. I also got a guitar. My dad and stepmom got me my first guitar when I was 14 or 15. Then I got an acoustic guitar, and I guess then I was really writing songs more. I started performing out in college when I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, first at the open mic there on campus, and then around West Philadelphia and downtown Philadelphia. And that's when I started writing things that I would still be proud to perform today.
The second grade jam? Come on, man. Like,
yeah.
There's something to that kind of early, like, boundlessness songwriting, like, lesson. knowing that mm-hmm. it can be anything, and like there isn't a form, and it's just you can write like on a drum set. Like, yeah, I think that's really, it's a really like kind of unique freedom and experience to have that at the very beginning for you.
Well, thanks for saying so. And yeah, when I was writing songs, I remember that they were really loose, had no real structure when I was 13 and 14 and wanted to play in a band with my school friends, bringing songs to them. You know, I didn't really know anything about the structure. I remember also listening to the radio as a kid and just whatever hit radio was on in the 90s and being really bored during the verses and then really, really excited when the big chorus would come in. And I remember thinking, why can't the whole song be that exciting? So I guess later I just started to pay attention to each moment of a song and they all, a lot of them are really fluid structurally. I kind of have to, and I do intentionally sometimes think, I'd like to write a verse, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus song just as an exercise. So everything is better now that you're around, I think is one of the few songs on the album that has a kind of a standard pop song structure.
Yeah, I noticed that, like, and also, I mean, also kind of, I feel, but that structure for that message kind of fits well. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a comforting song and delivering that what you're trying to say to this individual in that song, I think that makes sense that it would kind of, the structure would relate to that.
Sure.
I was going to say, but that's super interesting. That's even just as like a high schooler to notice that, like, hey, these choruses are sick, but these verses, I never remember what they say. Just get to the...
You're right.
That's a like real interesting, because I think we all experience that to some degree when we listen to music, like this part of the song, that's what I remember. It, you know what I mean? Like there's more production clearly involved in a chorus and like... but it's one thing to just to sub like consciously absorb that and then to kind of notice that, because with I guess when yeah. I relate it to my songwriting journey, I didn't really start noticing that until I started trying to record stuff. Like I felt it, but I couldn't really tell you what was going on. But okay, so you start playing guitar and you're playing in like rock bands. What was it in 13, 14? Was it like cover groups? Were you like, you're pitching songs to them, but were you guys doing that?
Oh, I would say like saying a band or a group is a huge overstatement.
Okay.
It was just like meeting with a couple kids a couple times, and I don't think anything ever really happened with it.
Okay. But still, those first couple, like, oh man, we got multiple people here and we're all supposed to get together. You know what I mean? Like... It's kind of like, unless you were like, were you a band kid? Were you in band in school or choir?
For a while, yeah. I took violin lessons for a little while in fifth grade, but that was kind of on my own. I remember writing songs on the violin too. And then I kind of stopped that in part because I was going to pick up the drum, and which, you know, was just a snare drum for a fifth or sixth grade kid. So I did that for a few years, and then I was in junior high chorus as well.
Okay, all right. So you had, so that's kind of like a vast, like, different. You're getting exposure to a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
Because violin's tricky, man.
Yeah.
But so with choir, like, and I guess as far as your singing journey too, was it clear when you were doing choir in school that like. Like, I have a spot, I know what my range is, I feel like I can deliver.
I haven't really thought about it in a long time. I guess so.
Yeah?
That's awesome. I'm sorry to not give a great answer.
No, it's fine, because it's a weird time in our lives, right? And we're trying to figure out what we want to do and who we are. And, like, to be, like, a... to be confident that I have a voice and I can write my own songs, for me, took a while to accept that I could sing and get better at it. You know what I mean? Like, it was a tiered thing. And like, I always wanted to be good at it, and I'm still working really hard to be okay at it, you know? But it was like, it wasn't a thing like I knew clearly. And when I was in, because I did choir in middle school, but I always like pretend to sing. I was like one of those, like, you know? but there'd be some kids there that just knew they can do it. And I was like, that's cool. So you know what I mean?
Like, I see. You know, that helps, because I, as a contrast, I would say, yeah, I was probably singing out and it was part of my, yeah. I think I was a pretty confident singer in the group. I don't know. I'm friends with my old teacher, Mr. Zimmerman, on Facebook. Maybe I'll ask him if he remembers.
That's awesome too. That's cool. Like, I have a couple high school teachers I stay connected with. One of which, who also has a Z name too, Zrenner.
Whoa, cool name.
Whoa, yeah, yeah. Zimmerman's pretty cool too, though. Man. So yeah. Anyway, so you get into college, and then you're starting to hit the open mic night scene. And for me, the open mic night scene in Cleveland, Ohio, was very, very impactful and very important, and something I still try to give back to today. Now, in college, too, it's an interesting, like, because I ran a couple college open mics, and, like, when I was in college, and, like, it's a, you get an interesting, like, kind of array. There's, like, a rush of people who have time to do it, and it's, like, this beautiful blossoming, like, event, and everyone's being super supportive. Then midterms come, they all disappear. like, as far as, like, getting your songwriting and getting out there as a performer, was this more of, like, kind of closing the rope near what you wanted to do, like, what you're doing now?
Yeah, I'd say so. I was doing my own songs then, occasionally with a few people I played with briefly in college, and really just getting my first sea legs as a performer. I remember it was such a big deal to do one of my songs in front of like 20 people or 30 people at this open mic that I was sick to my stomach all the day previous, you know, unable to sleep well all night. Sick with nerves all day, get up and just give the song my best and then be really sick for a few more hours. You know, just a huge, huge deal for me to go out and perform in front of people. But it gave me my early experience of what it was like to be up on a stage, a really valuable thing. And now I still get nervous, but I'm much more comfortable and kind of able to feed off that nervous energy and maybe adrenaline and channel it into a stronger performance.
I definitely think it's a good thing the nerves never go away. Like, it's always a good thing to be kind of shook by it, because it keeps it alive and keeps you, like, especially if you do a new thing. It's like you get something that worked. I guess going through those mic nights, did you start to notice songs that you wrote at that time that really worked?
I wouldn't say I noticed anything specific from the open mic. You know, it's such a hodgepodge of different characters who may be into a completely different scene. And, you know, it's not necessarily they're there to hear my kind of music. They're there to do with their own thing. So I would say I picked up more about what songs worked and what didn't just from feedback and getting them around and maybe starting to do other shows.
Gotcha. So yeah. I guess how long did it take to go from mic nighting to like gigs? Cause this was in Philadelphia, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Let's see. I started doing my first gigs. I did a show off campus my second year. So I started doing the open mics right away. My first year, my second year, I did three songs at a Monday night cabaret at the old Khyber Pass pub. And that was almost an open mic night, but it was downtown, you know, in a popular music venue. That went well. And then somebody who's still a really good friend of mine today, Rich Wexler, he runs Vintage Annals Archive on Instagram, and he's acting as my manager now. He saw a picture of me on MySpace way back. I miss MySpace. I don't know why we left it for Facebook. I still don't know why. It was great.
I know. You can play your one song. You can.
But he saw a picture of me, and that was kind of glammy, and he thought, I'd like to book this guy just based off the picture. So I started doing shows out in West Philly at different cafes, and from then on, just a whole bunch of shows all over Philly. But yeah, it's nice to still have that connection with him. That was pretty soon after the start of my second year that happened, I think.
Okay. That's awesome. Like, because that's, as someone who kind of runs Mike Nights, like the one thing you want to happen is to see someone find themselves and then go do it, you know, or see two people hang out and then that guy's the bass player and that guy, you know what I mean? Like, and she's a singer and now they're gigging. Like, that's the goal of the Mike Night, is to have that kind of dirt, that soil that the plant of the artist can grow out of. So,
Oh, it's a beautiful thing. You sound like a really generous person, and really, I'm glad that you're in that role, helping that happen.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. My band, we've played in Philly a couple times. We played in Connie's Rick Rack. Have you ever been there?
I don't think so. But I should say I haven't been in Philadelphia in the Philly scene for a little over a decade. I've been up in the Hudson Valley for a while.
Gotcha. Okay. And the other place was the Grape Room.
I don't think I know it.
I forget where that one was. But anywho, they both were cool venues. That's why I was bringing it up. I'm like, one was by Pat and Gino's. The
funny.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, so you're out there, and like, is that when you start writing on your own and like composing like digital, like with these digital instruments and working on that type of music, or is this kind of just a cluster of everything happening at once?
When I was doing those early gigs in Philly?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say the stuff you're hearing me put out now is sort of a continuation of that. It's just I was using much more primitive tools back then, and no budget to speak of, just putting songs together with the best way I could on what I had.
And like, I guess, did you like, cause just even like how you brought up, like at a younger age, being able to hear the difference of a chorus and the verse, was song structure something that came to you, or is this something, did you study like songwriting, like during this kind of like formative period?
I never formally studied music, other than that Mr. Zimmerman. I had a course with him and a course in college, not much stuck with music theory. And I did take a pop songwriting course at Temple University, but I wouldn't say I really got a whole lot out of it, just sort of practice. I think most of what I've learned has been through discussing music with and listening to music from my older brother, Nate, and just from listening to a lot of music and reading and listening to interviews with musicians I admire and just picking things up.
Was it like, that's pretty profound. Cause when I listen to your stuff, I'm like, this guy knows something, you know what I mean? This guy's composing, like this guy's thinking theoretically in some things here.
Well, thanks. Like, yeah, my tip is just to listen to a shit ton of Burt Bacharach.
There we go. All right. I was going to say, who's your brother? Who's Nate showing you? Like, after you start off with Bowie and... he gave you Lou Reed. After you start off with Lou Reed, where does that grow?
Sure. Well, I was a huge Velvet Underground fan and a fan of Warhol's Factory Scene, you know, and as a teenager. And I'm from really rural upstate Pennsylvania. There was just nothing around. These other worlds were just like a dream thing going on somewhere else. And when I came of age, that these scenes, you know, New York City was no longer attainable. Wasn't a place you could afford to live in. The scene up in the Hudson Valley is about the closest I can come to that now. It's a really great place up here. Let's see. Probably an example that was set largely by Nate, but I think just my own natural taste too are kind of all over the place. Like my my other members of my family are like that too. Like they just, they're not really limited by specific genres. It's just what good music is out there. It takes many, many forms. And for me, so much of it is just words, melody, and harmony. And a lot of genre and type of music just has to do with whether you used a banjo or a synthesizer to arrange it. You know, it's just kind of all the same stuff, whether it's like classic country, which I love, whether it's Irving Berlin or Burt Bacharach or post-punk or whatever. It's all the same stuff to me.
It's just those different timbres. I think that's well said.
Thanks.
Does Nate play? Or your sister? Is there any other musicians in the family?
Yeah, my sister plays trumpet. She's always played trumpet in band, and she still plays trumpet in a community band at Temple University. My brother was a songwriter and frontman for many bands is in the Boston area. For the past decade or so, he's been a gay nightlife DJ in Boston and Provincetown. And he's also producing music, and he helped me a good deal with the new album, with engineering feedback and whatnot.
That's awesome. That's a super cool like way to have a relationship with like your brother or siblings when you're all like working on your own thing like that, and he can like do the older brother, you need to raise the mids or whatever, you know what I mean? Like whatever you know what I mean? Like
yeah, that's pretty much what it was like. He was and my album was missing a lot of low end, so he was like, you need to raise the low end. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's got to be kind of hard to mix a low end in like an orchestra kind of based instrumentation compared to like digital, like, you know, like with a bass synth, you know what you're cranking, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I got to imagine with this ensemble, the bass is kind of coming from multiple instruments, right?
Well, that's true. And I might be odd in that there's not a lot of bass on the album. Like the double bass is only on 4 songs. The cello doesn't go as low as the double bass, of course. The cello is not on every song either. But yeah, a lot of it is just a mix of the piano playing a little lower. Yeah, it's not really like there's just a bass playing in a certain frequency the whole time.
So I'd imagine that would be kind of hard to like turn up the bass on and you're like, eh.
Yeah, and bass is notoriously hard to mix in a project studio.
Yeah.
You know, I just did this in my home studio. So
okay. Yeah, I guess
it's always hard.
Yeah, for sure. No, when you're doing it like you did, that's pretty incredible. This is all home studio made, man, because it sounds really, really good. It doesn't sound like that. Anything wrong with doing it in a home studio, but it definitely doesn't come off like that.
Well, I knew that doing an album like this with all these musicians, there are about 11 different musicians playing on the record, about 12 to 15. I don't remember offhand. There's a lot of different like orchestral instruments playing, but they're not all playing at once. You know, their instruments are very sparse. And so to like go into a studio would be multiple days and paying people to sit around half the time. And it just was not going to be feasible, especially during this was 2021 when I recorded this. You know, in the early sessions, we were still all wearing masks. So it just wasn't really possible to gather all these people around and do it all at once. So I recorded them one by one at home, and I upgraded my equipment instead of spending a lot of money on studio time. But it's just 3 microphones that are on the entire album. And then I did get the album mastered by Peerless Mastering in Boston, Massachusetts, who are a pretty high-end mastering studio. And I thought that'll be like a good way to compensate, to, you know, give it a great polish when it's all done.
Yeah, mastering's is like its own. That's very like there's already enough of a learning curve for what you did. You know what I mean? Like with mastering, that's a whole nother like niche learning curve that, at least for me, I don't know. I know what it is and like the big picture of why you master, but how to do it, I've always went to someone for that. So
sure. Daniel, you're right. It's very different from mixing. It involves different equipment, different skill set, for sure.
Did you, I guess, okay, so kind of sit in both chairs here. Was it easy for you to step aside from the performance, your performance, and hear the piece? Because sometimes when you're recording, you kind of get tunnel vision with your performance. You're like, yeah, I said the word the weird. Hold on, let me do, you know what I mean? Like, you start to tunnel into a thing. And to be able to do that, to just get your part right and step away and get the other parts where they need to be, was that something that came easy to you?
Probably none of it came easy. The whole thing was really, really tough. I would say, if you're talking specifically about vocals, because I did do the piano and the guitar, those were, you know, I had to do a lot of piano takes. Those were fairly easy. Doing the vocal is really a chore. But at that point, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing that most people are going to hear and most people are going to pay attention to at first. So it's also really important. I'll say, you know, I had really good feedback on that too, from my friend Heidi and from Andrew Stein, who gave me a lot of feedback. Andrew Stein is listed as a co-producer on the album, and he's a friend of mine and music teacher in the Hudson Valley. And it was really, really great to feel like I had a companion through this, because making music in an album, every little detail is a decision that you have to make. And this something this complex is just an unending, huge list of small decisions that can drive you a little nuts. So having somebody to say, like, is the tempo, you know, what tempo should we use for this song? Or like, is this vocal take right? You know, it's just like having these things, having somebody to help you out with that stuff is, so you're not all alone, is really, really nice. So yeah, I also took a couple voice lessons with him as I started the process to get back into it. He was a big help with that.
Like, it's critical. It's critical to get out of your own head like that and just have someone be like, yeah, it's fine. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? That's so, at least for me, I don't mean to say you, but like, I find like I get way into like the weeds of, especially with vocal stuff. Cause exactly what you said, it's going to be the most of the time it's going to be the thing that someone either flips the track or keeps going with it. If it's, you know, acceptable or not to them. That's cool that you had this feedback, right?
Yeah. I'll say it also helped that it took so long to make, and it's really important to put things away and come back to them later, because you do stop hearing things that otherwise would be pretty obvious. Like, I have to work at singing on pitch, and I just don't hear, even in instruments sometimes, if things are way off pitch, because I'm just in the middle of it and hearing it all the time, it doesn't really stand out. But I put things away and come back to them later, I'm like, oh my gosh, how did I not notice that?
That's true. It's so true, because you get so, like, you get that tunnel vision of what you're doing and, like, or what's, you know. So I 100% agree with what you're saying with that. Like, a big chunk of my group's recording process is elongated in comparison to a lot of other acts that kind of go in and track in a couple days and then they're done. I've been working with a guy and just kind of go in a little bit every week, you know, mm-hmm. And then like maybe a year later it's all put together. But by the time that one's done, the next one's half started. And it's, I think it's a good, like how you said, it's a good way to kind of set it aside, come back, be like, what was I thinking? And move on from that, you know? And I guess the reason I really wanted to sketch out this kind of musical journey so far is like a lot of this record is kind of like an ode to that, right?
An ode to the musical journey?
To your musical journey.
I wouldn't say consciously an ode to my own journey. Like, do you mean my own life and creative process? And let's see. Well, there are certain things on the album that deal with the nature of creativity. And in fact, the title Out of the Nowhere into the Here is about the creative act, about how something suddenly appears that never existed before. I don't know if I would say I was consciously referencing like my history in music, like my journey exactly. Is that helpful?
Yeah, no, for that's your experience, man. No, I totally, like, you know what I mean? Sure. Like just kind of going off the title and some of the digging into you a little bit, it kind of seems like it's a celebration of that, or an ode to your creative journey and what music meant to you. And to where it's at, like, and then what came out of it, which is this record.
Yes, I see what you mean.
So that's at least that's kind of what I was taking. And like lyric, like, because so much lyrically is like, and these structures are all over the place, which keeps it really, really interesting. But lyrically, it's very like, at least it perceives as very vulnerable and very open with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, it may be, it may not be, but as someone who's listening, that's how I'm interpreting it. So that's where I kind of, that this kind of endeavor, this ode to like this, how you, even just like how you pointed out with the title, here it is. But anyway, I guess another tune I wanted to ask about in particular, let me phrase it like this. With the act of singing and kind of working to be on pitch, and like that's something I also work really hard to do, like, but it's the practice of like breathing and like kind of there's this whole aspect of that, and like you also do Kundalini, which is a very particular breathing based yoga, correct?
No, I don't really do Kundalini. Or yoga in particular. I had an accidental Kundalini awakening, the actual feeling of electricity going up my body, which is the experience I describe on There Was a Light. But it's not. I'm not actually a practitioner of any particular thing.
But it was, yeah. So what can you dive into? What brought that experience? Like,
oh. Well, I was going through a really exciting time in my music a while back, and I was awake in the middle of the night, kind of excited about what was going on, and I thinking about my life and why I'm a songwriter. And at some point, my mind centered on the strange feeling that probably you also can relate to, and many of your listeners can, of where an idea popped into your head that just didn't exist before, a melody. And as I thought about this, I felt the these waves of electricity going up my torso, and then off as I started thinking about something else. And I noticed it, kind of filed it away. A few weeks later, something else was going on in my life that was really exciting, and I was awake again in the middle of the night. I thought, I wonder if I could make that happen again. So I thought about where those melody ideas come from, and again, I felt the waves of electricity going up my torso, and then off again as I thought about something else. And I definitely wondered what was going on. I mentioned it to my mom, who said, I think you're having a spiritual awakening. And then a friend of mine who said more specifically that it was a Kundalini awakening. And I didn't know what this stuff was. I'd heard of chakras, but I didn't really know anything about them. I really freaked out that I was having an apparent mystical, whether I was or wasn't, that's what I thought at the time. And I really, really freaked out about what this all meant, about connecting with whatever this energy was just by thinking about where ideas. It's a pretty strange idea for a Westerner. I ended up having a massive panic attack, and my friends took me to the hospital to reset. And there I felt, you know, I calmed down. I got up my first good night of sleep in a while, and I was awakened in the middle of the night by a light above me with just what just felt like pure love coming down on me from this light. And then it was off, and it went back. It definitely wasn't a dream, but I remembered it in the morning very clearly. And yeah, so
jeez, man.
That was
wow.
That.
Wow. That's intense. That's intense. But
yeah,
like,
it was very intense.
Like the morning after, like I gotta imagine, like especially going through like a kind of severe kind of panic attack like that, and like, but that morning after that, was there? What was that like? Was that like?
Well, I was in a pretty rough state for a while. I didn't know where I was. It turned out I was in the psych ward, and they thought I had bipolar disorder, which it took me a long time, you know, years afterward, to convince them that I did not have bipolar disorder. So I was in the psych ward for about a week, and then shortly after that, I had to go back to work. And it's really, really hard to just go back to work at your computer job, typing on your computer as though that matters, you know. Hey, I just got this gift from another dimension. Now I've got to like go back to work, and this is what's important, you know. But I was traumatized by the whole thing. I mean, it took me a long time. I had to actually put music away for years because the experience dealt with creativity, and I just had to focus on, you know, dealing with trauma. And you know, I'd be at work typing, and my mind would drift off to the light, and I'd realize I'd been staring off into space for a while, and I had to remind myself to keep working. So for a while, it was tough to keep my job. I was working at Etsy at the time. I worked at Etsy for 12 years until just this past December. They were very, very supportive. You know, it was a great career, and I'm really glad I stuck around for so long. But that was that. And at some point, I guess I had struggled with whether to make a song about it. But I realized, you know, I'm a songwriter. I write about stuff that comes to mind. It was always on my mind. So it just kind of came out, and that's what came out.
Well, it's a beautiful tune. And like,
thank you.
I appreciate you sharing that experience, because that's a super intense experience. But I'm glad it's gotten you to where you are right now. And like, you know, because like this, I got to imagine all that struggle and all that to have a reprieve to it is super important and super, you know, a thing to acknowledge. And I'm trying to find my right word for it, but you know, it's super important to acknowledge that all that led to this, which is good. Not even just the project, but where you are, you know?
Yeah, I feel the best I've ever felt in my life, mentally and physically and creatively. I'm having a good time, you know. So I guess it is good.
It's good, man. It's good. You got this.
Thanks. thanks.
Well, okay. Steve, I really appreciate your time. I got one more question I want to get into you with. I saw recently, and I think you noticed because I added you on Instagram earlier today, even though I think I followed you a week or so ago with the other profiles. But you did gigs with Charming Disaster. And like, or
yeah, who you had on your show, sure.
Yeah, and those guys are awesome. Do you know them, or like, how did that come together?
So, Elia from Charming Disaster is involved, like an employee with the Bindlestiff Family Circus, they are based in Hudson, New York, which is where I live. Elia had played an open mic that I actually hosted an open mic myself at the now defunct Club Helsinki in Hudson, New York, and Elia had come and played there, so I remembered her. And I knew her, I think, maybe a little bit through the Bindlestiff. And then the Bindlestiff asked me if I might be interested in playing with them in a Hudson gig. So this was actually, I think it might have been the first summer of the pandemic that we did this show together at an outdoor venue set up in a parking lot on a stage with the audience, you know, 6 feet, the audience, you know, outside, but all masked, all sitting very, very far from the stage, all sitting 6 feet apart from each other. Just a weird way to perform, but it worked and we did it. And we were glad to, I think, have a gig. I forget if that was that gig or I did two shows like that. One with Brian Dewan, who's a local musician, you know, a wonderful artist, songwriter. And one with Charming Disaster, but that's basically how it came together. And Elia's, I know Jeff too. Elia, you know, they supported my Kickstarter, helped me make the album. They've given me a lot of a lot of advice, just really sweet people as well as great musicians and songwriters.
It warms me to see the open mic night host gene I have now, like to see like even people I've met via this podcast like mingling and supporting each other. That's so cool, man. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything we didn't get to that you want to cover? Like anything to plug before we wrap it up?
When will this air?
Okay, so it's next week, like 2 weeks from now.
Okay, so I'll see if anybody's listening and can come to the Hudson Valley. I'll be at Avalon Lounge April 25th in Catskill, New York, for the big album release show. The full album comes out April 19th. And I'll be at Green Kill in Kingston, New York, on Wednesday, May 22nd. That will be in person and streaming online, so anybody can see it. And I'm performing these days with a mix of orchestral musicians, about five, to fill out the arrangements. We've been putting on great shows here in the Hudson Valley. Looking forward to booking shows outside the region too.
Awesome. Very cool. I forgot, there's also a whole instrumental version of this record that's coming out with the full put together version. And that all comes out on the same time, right?
That's correct. Yeah. The instrumental version of There Was a Light just came out a week or two ago, along with the vocal version as a single. So on that song, it's the same like instrumental bed as the vocal album. I take the vocal album off, and where the piano isn't playing the melody, I had an instrument playing the melody. And on There Was a Light, because musically it's just the same thing repeating five times, I had a clarinet duet with a heckel phone, which is a rare instrument, a combination between a bassoon and an oboe. And the clarinet and heckel phone duet on it. And I wrote an extra, a little duet just to make it a little bit more interesting for the listener.
That's cool. The heckel phone. I've never heard of that. That sounds like a guy in the audience who's just like, hey, play Freebird. I'm the heckle phone. You know what I mean? It sounds like some dude's excuse to be a jerk. Like, that's so cool, man. Well, very cool. Well, Steve, thank you so much for chatting with me. And I dearly appreciate your time, man. So,
I appreciate you having me on. It's been a great chat, and I'll look forward to listening more to your podcast. I enjoyed the Charming Disaster one as well as the one with John Doe I listened to just yesterday. It was fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, John Doe has been one of me and my bass players, like X is one of our favorite bands. So that was super cool.
Yo, Spike Spiegel here. You just listened to Zig of the Gig podcast. Keep riding the bebop. See you, Space Cowboy. Bang.